आत्मा त्वं गिरिजामते सहचरा प्राणाशरीरं गृहं पूजाते विषयोपभोगरचना निन्द्रासमाधिस्थिति संचारपदयोः प्रदक्षिणविधि स्तोत्राणि सर्वागिरो यन्यत्कर्म करोमि तत्तदखिलं शम्भो तवाराधना. O Lord, may we feel that Thou art the soul of our souls, that it is Thine energy which is functioning as our mind and intelligence. May our bodies be Thine abode, and all our enjoyments be as offerings unto Thee. May our powers and desires be the companions of Thy will, and our lives the instruments of Thy purpose. May our every word be a hymn unto Thee, our every act Thine adoration, our every step a pilgrimage to Thy shrine. And may we realize, O Lord, that all we see is lighted by Thy light, that the universe and all its beings are Thy very self. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being, may the Divine Being support and nourish us as mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Peace 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 be unto us all. Good morning and greetings after the annual vacation. This is the beginning of my year. Maybe the end of yours, but it's the beginning of mine. And I'm glad, in a way, to be back and to be with you all once again. I've missed you, although I didn't have much chance to do that. Before I start the topic, I just want to point out the name of a book that I discovered on vacation and which might interest some of you. It's quite a good book. It's called Six Questions of Socrates. Do you know it? By Christopher Phillips. If you want to take it down, I put it down. I put it on the board here. We take it down. Very philosophical book, and also a very timely one. Well, our subject today is announced as sleep, dream, and spiritual vision. And as always, when I discuss this topic, I feel not only inadequate, of course, because it's such a tremendous topic, but I also feel rather sorry for the audience or for the listeners, because I know that what I have to say sounds to the Western ear as so unlikely, so improbable, so topsy-turvy, going against everything you've learned. We've learned from our childhood in the West. And unbelievable on first hearing. I'm hoping that some of you have heard it enough times now already that you can begin to attempt a little belief in it. But to accept it outright is only the result of long spiritual discipline and maturation. You cannot grasp this probably in any believable sense without a great deal of sadhana. But anyway, that's what we have to do. We have to start. We start, you see, from such different assumptions. Sleep. Just take, I'm going to do it this way. I'm going to spend quite a lot of time on sleep and quite a lot of time on dream. And whatever time is left, I'll talk about spiritual vision. After all, how many of us are having spiritual vision? But we all sleep and we all dream. So it's very important that we understand the philosophy, the Vedanta philosophy has to say about this. Sleep. You're taught by biology and hygiene and all of the things we learn in school and from our parents that everybody sleeps. Animals sleep. All kinds of creatures sleep. And human beings, being another form of animal, sleeps. He sleeps. And we're told that it's necessary for the recuperation and rest and recuperation of the mind and body. Certainly it is. And there are people who make a psychological study of dreams, but they're considered sort of crackpots, maybe, not taken too seriously. Other than that, sleep for us is just one more biological phenomenon which we can do well or do ill according to our situation in life. Well, in Vedanta, we make a different assumption. Instead of looking upon sleep as something by the way, we look upon all of the states of consciousness with equal, this chair is over here, with equal seriousness. All the states of consciousness with equal seriousness. Come around here. That is to say, I give the same value if I'm seriously practicing Vedanta. I have to give the same value to the dream state and to the deep sleep state that I give to the waking state in terms of appreciation. I can't live, perhaps, my chosen life in all three states equally, but I have to value sleep and dream as being comparable to the waking state in terms of reality. The question involved here is, what is reality? The sense of reality is what gives us the life that we are living. I live in this waking state. I call this my life. I don't call my dream world my life. I don't call my deep sleep state my life. This is my life because here I have a physical body and a mind, body-mind organism, which has all of the familiar rules and customs of biological life. And so I call this my life, but is it mine? How do I dare to call it mine? That's one question. And the other questions are, in my dream state, who is dreaming? Am I dreaming or not? Somebody else dreaming for me? Some kind of cosmic mind is doing the dreaming? These are the questions we have to ask. And in the deep sleep state, have I died? How come I come back to life? I'm not aware of myself there. I have no consciousness of myself in the really deep sleep state. And yet, I appear, reappear. How do I reappear from the deep sleep state? These are questions which we have to take up and consider this morning, insofar as I have time and am able to do so. Let's take this I sense, first of all. The sense of I am. Now, I think you will know, will follow me with this. There are times, and even in the waking state, where I don't feel self-conscious. I don't feel I sense. I have forgotten myself, we say. Swami Vivekananda says, those are the happiest hours of your life. He says those are the happiest hours of your life when you have forgotten yourself. Completely absorbed in something. Self has vanished, as it were. But most of the time, I am conscious that I am doing this, I am enjoying that, I am related to so-and-so, I am the son or daughter of so-and-so. I have this physical configuration. I came from such and such a family. This is called the ego. The ego which identifies us as individuals. Now come to the dream state. Do you not acknowledge that there is usually a sense of ego there? You feel in the adventures of your dreams that you are mixed up with some crowd you never saw before. You can take this chair here if you like. Right here. Can you get it? There it is. Thank you. You know that in that situation where you are living out a dream experience, you have a sense of identity. You have a sense of being there. You are somebody who is doing something. And you also know this, don't you? That it's not the same ego as in the waking state. Otherwise, how could it be that I seem to become somebody of a totally different age, different height, weight? So many different experiences are come to us in dreams where we transform ourselves into figures that either we know or we didn't know before. New figures, old figures. So the ego is one thing in our waking state and another thing in our dream state. And in the deep sleep states, we call it sushupti, in the deep sleep state, the ego, you can't say it vanishes. If it totally vanished, how would it come back? It doesn't die. It doesn't disappear. Yes, it disappears. But it doesn't evaporate. The ego in the deep sleep state is in lapse, in suspension. If you take example of a sine curve, the waves, and here are the waves in the waking state, it's like you see on an electroencephalogram. Or here are the waves in the dream state, a little slower, a little more or less complicated, maybe. In the deepest sleep state, flat out, or very, very little vibration occurring in the mental stuff, the substance of the mind. So we have three different conditions in which the ego operates and or doesn't operate. How does it reappear? How does it come back from the deep sleep state? You know, there are two ways of coming back. Sometimes you come from deep sleep back into dream, then dream some more before you wake up. Sometimes you can go straight from the deep sleep state to a waking state. Somebody wakens you suddenly, pulls you out of deep sleep. There you are. You have no chance to dream again. So you went from deep sleep to waking state, and here's your ego. See how our approach is psychological. See how we're looking at it now, not from a biological standpoint. We're not making the assumption that the mind is a product of the brain. We in Vedanta do not make the assumptions that science makes, that biology makes, about the human organism. That this is the given reality, and the other things which come into our life in which we participate are lesser realities, somehow shadows or pale reflections of this life, the waking life. We don't do that. We have to acknowledge in Vedanta that we are equally, that the three states are equally important to our understanding of the nature of reality. Now, of course, I'm going to have to point out before we go any further that the nature of reality will be discovered by us only when we have transcended these three states. These are the states of Jagrata, Swapna, and Sushupti, waking, dream, and sleep. And there is something called the fourth, Turiya. When we are talking about the three states that I've just mentioned, the next thing we have to talk about is the fourth. It's called that. Turiya means fourth in Sanskrit. And that is a state of superior reality to all the other three. How do we get there? Well, that's another whole story. We don't have to get there. We are there. That state is not the fourth. It's the permanent state. It's only the fourth when we're talking about the three. Beyond the three, the fourth state is our permanent, enduring reality, our state of consciousness, which never fails, never can be negated, never can be erased, never can be changed. That's called the Atman. The Atman consciousness underlies all three of these states. Right now, here, we are talking, sitting, communicating, and that present, that Atman is present through, in and through everything that we are doing, underneath everything. If we all went to sleep now, we all dreamed differently. Maybe some of us might dream the same dream. That'd be very unusual. We'll all dream differently, and then that the same Atman lies behind that state. If we all fell into deep sleep suddenly, maybe a gas was brought into the room or something, we all went into deep sleep, God forbid. But if that happened, Atman is there, witnessing what has happened, because it is the witness of all the states. Now you may ask, well, why don't we experience, why don't we know, why don't we feel this Turiya? Why aren't we aware of the deep-seated underlying consciousness which is the basis and support, the substratum of our whole mental existence, mental and physical existence? Why aren't we? Because we're ignorant. You can give lots of explanations. And the only real explanation, the only really helpful explanation, is to say, we have not yet prepared our mind and body to accept that experience. That experience of pure consciousness, which is our true nature. We cannot yet sufficiently appreciate and experience because we are undeveloped creatures in the spiritual sense. That's another way of putting it. Well, I want to go on now. That's sleep in general. I know that there have been lots of sleep experiments, sleep deprivation in the laboratory. People have been kept awake for days and nights just to see what would happen. This is the Western way of doing things, you know. Just to see what would happen. See what would happen to the people who they're when they're exposed to sleeplessness. And they found that all kinds of psychological problems arise. There are schizophrenic tendencies, paranoid tendencies. There all kinds of psychic problems come from sleep deprivation. The explanation given by medicine, by medical science, will be that the physical organism and the brain, including the brain, require respite, rest, in order to function properly. We do not deny that. We do not deny that. But we give another, deeper reason for our needing to sleep. And that is this. This physical life of ours, imprisoned in this body, is too limiting. It's too confining. We meet finitude everywhere we go. At every step we meet finitude. Everything that we try to do blocks us, limits us. I can't win the Olympic race because somebody else was better at it. I can't do the gymnastics because someone else has practiced it better. I feel limited. If I don't get the psychological and spiritual escape from this cage of flesh, every so often, for so many hours, my feeling of frustration, my feeling of limitation, of unreality, will become so intense, I cannot bear it. So, the necessity for sleep is explained in Vedanta in a different way from that in the laboratory. You can try to accept both if you can. Let's go on to dream. There are so many interesting phenomena in dream, and I have made a lifelong study of it. If you haven't, I'd be surprised. Probably you have been bemused and amused by your dreams and dream experiences as much as I have. But there are some very important features, spiritually speaking, Vedantically speaking, there are important features about dream. Let me first of all take Shankaracharya's famous explanation. Now this is what I would call the orthodox Hindu passing off of the life of dream. Shankara says our dreams are made up of experiences from this life, the day's experiences, and past lives. And there are people who, taking that seriously, try through hypnotism to regress us to the past lives which have given us those experiences. From what I have been able to understand from my study of it, most of these are bogus explanations. Most of these are bogus discoveries, because suppose the person is asked, in which life are you recalling yourself now? And they mention that particular life, say, 1800s. I was a maid in the Buckingham Palace. In 1800. Next question. What clothes are you wearing? Can't do it. Can't do it. Wrong clothes. What does that tell you? Are you looking at something real, or are you creating something to give the experimenter an answer? You know the experimenter wants an answer, so the subconscious mind brings up an answer. Let's pass that explanation over. With all due respect to Shankara, I don't think dreams can be explained by the experiences of past lives. If you want to believe that, that's all right, you may do that. But the most important thing about most of our dreams is the ability to recognize. How do you recognize a figure in your dream? I remember a dream that I had. I tell it because it shows the principles involved. I had a dream in which I was talking with a man of my acquaintance. This person had died some years before, and I was talking with him without the realization that he died. I was talking to him about things we had in common. And suddenly, the thought, recognition came to me, this man is dead. This man's not living. How can I be talking to him when he's not living? And then I accepted it somehow. I accepted it. Well, okay, I said to myself. See, I can remember all this. I wrote it down. I can remember all this. I said to myself, well, I must be on another plane. In order to be able to talk to him, I must have been carried to another plane where I'm discussing things in his present state. And then somebody else came into the room who is a living person. And that living person, and the conjunction of the two, the contradiction of these two things, woke me up. I can't be talking to somebody who is dead on another plane and still be recognizing somebody who has come into the room who is living. Who is doing this dreaming? To what extent do we create the scenes of our dream? If we are the creators, then how does it happen that these things don't turn out the way we would like them to? Aren't we in control of our dreams? Why do we have nightmares? Why do I have bad dreams? Why should I, if I am the creator of my dreams? These are the questions that Vedanta asks, and they ask you to raise if you are a serious student. Let's go on to some other dream phenomena. Sometimes we dream in slow motion. Maybe some of you here have had a dream in which everything that you did was like in a slow motion picture. You know, when you slow down a film and you see people moving in slow motion. I have had dreams, other people have had them too, where everything was being done in slow motion, and that is a sign of beginning to get control over what's happening in the dream. Some of you know, I'll just make it personal for you, some of you know John Dobson. John Dobson was in the monastery with me, and one day he told us that he had, in his dream, he had faced such an extraordinarily horrible situation. It meant absolute annihilation. I can't imagine what it was. He didn't remember what it was. All he knew was, this situation is intolerable. I cannot stand it. And he proceeded to grow long claws like an animal, like a dragon, like you see in dragons' pictures. Long claws on his fingers, and with those claws he proceeded to tear himself apart, and he died. Now, you know John Dobson. You know that he's not going to tell fairy tales. Here is a man, a scientist, who dreams that he has committed suicide. Who is watching that dream? What is the consciousness that told John Dobson, I clawed myself to death and woke up and found I was alive? There is a witness. There's a witness that watches all our dreams. There's a witness even of our deep sleep state. That's the light of the Atman. And it's witnessing all of this. And when we wake up, that light of the Atman is still there. And with that light, we recognize reality. So during the dream, the horrible situation was real for him. The growing claws on his hands was real. Why did he want to commit suicide that way? God knows. Who knows? This mind of ours is such a strange animal. You really think you can understand the laws of the mind? I'm just, right now, just playing at it with you. I don't pretend to understand the laws of the mind. The human mind is so extraordinarily complex. But this much of the philosophy of Vedanta we have elucidated from centuries past. And this much we can put before you, that the only ultimate sense of reality is that which is permanent, which can never be erased, never be effaced, never be lost. So these are some of the... Oh, and then I remember another dream that I had myself. Somebody... I was involved in a holdup. You know, somebody had a gun, was holding a gun on me, and wanting my money, everything in my wallet, and so on. And in the dream, I somehow became aware, I recognized, in just a little bit of measure, that this cannot be a true situation. It's not, something is not right here. And in the twinkling of an eye, I had that gun in my hand. I had that gun in my hand, and he was being pointed at. How do you do that? Do you see what I'm getting up to? This world of ours is another kind of dream. From the highest standpoint, the waking state is another kind of dream. If you want to go to the truth, to the God who is beyond all falsehood and all shadow and all insubstantiality, go through the waking, through the sense of control, which carries you beyond even the waking state. In this waking state, we have the chance to control our lives, our thoughts, our emotions, our reactions. All of those things we have a chance to control. Whether we do it or not, another story. That control exists even in the dream. And when we begin to come from dream to waking, more and more control we can feel of the situations of the dream. And there are people who practice lucid dreaming. What is lucid dream? What is a lucid dream? A dream where you know that you are dreaming and beginning to wake up from it, and you try to control the factors and events in your dream before you wake up. That's called lucid dreaming. Well, let me tell you about some more things. I'll come back to the spiritual element later, where we actually have to use our power of control to bring us to the true reality. The problem about dream research in the external world is that there are new theories every few years. The experimenters in the dream laboratories are not using the same theories that they used a decade ago. And science is like that, you see. Science always comes up with some so-called improvement, and you find a new theory every so often. When people are deprived of dreams, not just sleep, but dreams. In other words, you know, REM, rapid eye movements, when they can tell when by rapid eye movements when you are dreaming. Now, the patient's in, on the table in the sleep laboratory, and they go poke him, wake him up. Every time they see the eyes moving in behind the eyelids, then that person is deprived of dreaming, because when we dream, we are looking with our eyeballs. This is the external explanation. We're looking with our eyeballs at scenes which we have thrown up in our mind, our dream world, and we're looking throughout that experience with movements of the eyeball. So if you wake a person up when their eyeballs are moving, you stop that dream. And if you do it properly, they can tell you what they were dreaming about, or whether they were can't tell you what they were dreaming about, and so on. So they make all these kinds of experiments. These are things that are done on the outside. And I'm asking you to make your experiments on the inside. You can't go to the sleep laboratory and work on somebody else's brain. The only brain you can work on is your own. That's the only one you really have a right to work on. So what we need more to do than external experimentation is internal experimentation. And we will, if we do it properly, we will discover the same truths that the ancient rishis discovered in the Vedas. The same truths will be discovered by us if we are earnest and sincere. That's what generations and generations and centuries of spiritual aspirants have discovered. Well, you know, dreams, another way of understanding our dreams is that they are often made up simply from one single word. I give you two examples. A lady was repapering her house, her bedroom. And she waited all morning for the paper hanger. They called them in those days paper hangers, people who put up your wallpaper. And the paper hanger didn't come. And so he turned up late with some excuse and couldn't do the work that day. She went to bed, she went to sleep at bedtime, and remembered in the morning that she had been in a dress shop. And in that dress shop, there were many of those, what do you call them? I don't know where the dresses hang. And those movable racks, that's what it is, racks. Those were many racks with dresses on them. And she was asking about different dresses and how much she'd have to pay. And the clerk told her, "Oh, in here you pay per hanger." "In this shop you pay per hanger." Now in the dream, she didn't recognize in the dream where that came from. But it came from the waking state into the dream in another form. The greatest trick of the human mind in dream is to disguise. You know that from Freud, from Freudian psychology, you know this. We disguise very often what we don't want, for some reason, maybe even trivial reason, to recognize right away. And here is another example of that. Somebody who had committed a crime, I don't know what it was, doesn't matter. Some man who had committed a crime went to sleep and dreamed about books in the library, books, shelves and shelves of books. And the books were all facing, instead of having the rib facing out, the ribs were facing in and the edges were facing out. And the edges were all gold. And the thought was going through his mind, oh, gilt-edged, gilt-edged, gilt-edged. G-U-I-L-T. Those are some of the best ones I have, the best examples I have of the ways that puns work in dreams. Dreams are full of puns. They often contain something that you don't recognize as a pun from the waking state. So Shankara is right to that extent that the material of our dreams comes from the day's waking, the waking day. In deep sleep state, they measure the vibrations of the brain, of the brain. They call it the mind, mind's vibration. And they discover that in deep sleep, just as I told you, it's a flat out experience, but there are little electrical impulses still recordable in the dreams, in the deep sleep state. There are still recordable, tiny electrical impulses recordable. Now, I'm putting two and two together that may not belong, but in Vedanta, in philosophy, we say, in the state of sushupti, or deep sleep, there are little wisps, remnants of ignorance called ajnana vrittis. Vrittis of ignorance. And now you see, these little vibrations are what keep us from having samadhi in deep sleep. I'm sure you all want samadhi. Everybody's heard about it, how glorious it is, nirvana. All these terms are there. We cannot experience the light of the Atman in deep sleep because these vestigial vibrations of ignorance are still there. And from them come the whole of our avidya, our ajnana, our prakriti experience. If we could just eliminate those last vestiges of ignorance, we would see why the Upanishads equate samadhi and deep sleep. The person of spiritual realization has the experience of samadhi instead of deep sleep, if he is in the fortunate enough to get that. Well, I must rush on. In fact, in deep sleep, there are those little vibrations. The more we seek causality, the less we find. We are trying here to put reasons and causes on things, but to ask why is to be a fool, somebody has said. To ask why, with respect to the human mind, is to be a fool. In Vedanta, the sense of reality is given to Brahman or Atman alone. And the three, you see, there are three spaces. We talk of three spaces you understand that when we dream, we are dreaming in the dream space. When we live in the waking state, we are in the gross space. And we say that when we are in the sushupti, or deep sleep state, we are in the causal space. So, let me describe how Vedanta explains the creation of the universe. Ishvara, God, conditioned by a little bit of ignorance with which he operates, hatches, designs the universe in the causal space, draws out the cartoon, the outline, the vague, the general outline in the dream space, and in the gross space, he fills in all the details. All these names and forms, colors, shapes, names, sizes, all of this comes out only in the gross space. So these match the three states of consciousness. Waking, in which we judge everything. Everything that we do is judged by the waking state. Let me give you another dream. There was a famous man named Robert Ingersoll, who was an atheist, agnostic, really. And he tells about a famous dream that he had. He says, I dreamt that there was a drama in which I was watching, a drama, some kind of a drama on a stage. Suddenly I became aware, I had a vague feeling that I was writing this play. This play was being written right out of my consciousness. Now, he said to himself, if that's the case, I should be able to know what the next speaker in the drama is going to say. I should be able to tell. And he waited for that, but the person in the dream said something different from what he thought it would be. And the shock of that woke him up. See what's happening there? You're becoming aware that all of this that you're seeing in the dream is coming somehow out of you. Whether you can put the ego label on it or not is not the important thing right now. The important thing is you are aware suddenly that this has been your creation. If so, says Ingersoll, I should be able to control it. I should know what this man's going to say. But the next sentence that the man said wasn't what he thought it would be. So, unreality, judgment comes. This is not real. I can't be really making this play. And he wakes up and finds a different ego. I'd like to stop at this point and give you a little of Alice in Wonderland. This is a trial in which Alice wakes up from her wonderland, her great dream, half the book. The king and the queen, I think it's the red king, the king and the queen, are sitting in the court, and the trial is being held. Let the jury consider their verdict, the king said for about the 20th time that day. No, no, said the queen. Sentence first, verdict afterwards. Alice Wonderland. Stuff and nonsense, said Alice loudly. She's using her discrimination. Stuff and nonsense, said Alice loudly. The idea of having the sentence first. Hold your tongue, said the Queen, turning purple. I won't, said Alice. Off with her head, the Queen shouted at the top of her voice. Nobody moved. Who cares for you, said Alice. She had grown to her full size by this time. You're nothing but a pack of cards. At this, the whole pack, Queen, King, Jack, King, Ace, Spades, and all sorts, all rose up upon her and came flying down upon her, and she gave a little scream, half of fright and half of anger, and tried to beat them off, and found herself lying on the bank with her head in the lap of her sister, who was gently brushing away some dead leaves that had fluttered down from the trees on her face. This is how Alice woke up from Wonderland, by asserting her own knowledge and understanding of reality. And that's how we have to wake up from the ignorance and the dream of this life, this world, and all that the Maya that we are involved in. We have to do it by that kind of a process. And that's what Jnana Yoga is, and that's what spiritual sadhana is. Let me read you another passage that shows what I've been talking about. The Red King is sleeping. It's the Red King snoring, making an awful noise. And Alice is with the twins, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, in Through the Looking Glass. Second part of the book. He's snoring loudly, fit to snore his head off, said Tweedledum. I'm afraid he'll catch cold lying on the damp grass, said Alice, who was a very thoughtful little girl. He's dreaming now, said Tweedledee. And what do you think he's dreaming about? Alice said, nobody can guess that. Why, it's about you, Tweedledee exclaimed, clapping his hands triumphantly. And if he left off dreaming about you, where do you suppose you'd be? Where I am now, of course, said Alice. No, indeed, Tweedledee retorted contemptuously. You'd be nowhere. Why, you're only a sort of thing in his dream. If that there king was to wake, added Tweedledum, you'd go out, bang, just like a candle. I shouldn't, Alice exclaimed indignantly. Besides, if I'm only a sort of thing in his dream, what are you, I should like to know? Ditto, said Tweedledum. Ditto, ditto, said Tweedledee. He shouted this so loud that Alice couldn't help saying, Shush, you'll be waking him, I'm afraid, if you make so much noise. Well, it's no use your talking about waking him, said Tweedledum, when you're only one of the things in his dream. You know very well you're not real. I am real, said Alice, and began to cry. You won't make yourself a bit realer by crying, Tweedledee remarked. There's nothing to cry about. If I wasn't real, Alice said, half laughing through her tears, it all sounded so ridiculous, I shouldn't be able to cry. I hope you don't think those are real tears, says Tweedledee. You see why Swami Vivekananda said that was his favorite book for children?
Yes.
It's not only favorite book for children, it's a favorite book for grown-ups. You see, the ego is needed. If Alice hadn't had in her dream of the Red King and the twins, her sense of her own worth, her own propriety, her own reality, if she hadn't had a comparing of her experience with her sense of what is real, she couldn't have wakened up from the dream in any way. And the same applies to us. We have to have the kind of self-sense, the kind of experience of reality testing, which gives us the incentive and the impulse and the power and the charge to find the unreality of this world of Maya and the reality of the Atman. Well, I said I was going to talk about spiritual visions. I see I have way too much material to get through today because I like the subject and I get carried away. But anyway, what do we mean by spiritual dreams? Some people come to me, you know, and they say, oh, I had such a wonderful dream the other night. In fact, people quite often come to the Swamis and tell them about their dreams. And I have discovered something very interesting, that there is a big cultural difference, a tremendous gulf culturally between the people of India and the people of the West when it comes to dreaming. Oh, at least 10 times as many Indian people have come and talked about having spiritual dreams as have Western people. So there's something in the culture of the land which makes a collective subconscious full of gods and goddesses, scriptures, scriptural quotations. Your childhood, who come from India, your childhood has been so different from ours. In Western dreams, as you go, if you understand reading by reading Jung or Freud, you discover that there are more of Grimm's fairy tales and wolves and Red Riding Hoods and sheep and all kinds of Western sorts of images that crop up in Western dreams, even when they're spiritual. So I don't know, that's something for another subject, another day. But this much I do want to tell you, that we classify dreams as far as being spiritual is concerned in three classes. There are those dreams in which you see a holy figure, a holy person, someone who is recognized spiritually. But they appear to you as ordinary people would, with no special marks, no particular defining characteristic that would make you sit up and take notice. And what they do in the dream is nothing particularly elevating. Perhaps I saw them go get a haircut or something. That is the lowest class. We say, it's good. You dreamt about so-and-so. Maybe it was your chosen ideal or someone whom you admire. You dreamt a dream about that person. Good, good dream. The next class, dreams, is one usually accompanied by light. There is a strong feeling of light in the dream, strong illumination, kind of illumination. And the person, the holy figure, or the holy experience which you have in that dream is highly significant. It's appropriate to the person you saw. That person would be doing that, or probably could be doing that. And there are the circumstances surrounding that person are logical. They're not crazy. They make sense. In other words, it's a kind of experience that you might have been having in the waking state. You see a halo around the person, or you see some kind of special mark that indicates to you that this is an appearance that you love, that you would like to have, and see them as. And those are very definitely spiritual dreams. One should be very happy if one sees the kind of a dream in which the holy element is rational, logical, could have been had in the waking state with all of our waking judgments. And beyond that is the true vision, and that's on another order. The true vision does what? Changes your whole life. The vision of God, vision of, in the case of Buddhists, the Nirvana experience, changes your whole life, molds and forms your character anew, never leaves you, you can never forget it. Well, it's on another whole level, a whole other level. Let me see what I wrote down here. I think I put some criteria. If you're in doubt, ask your guru. It's self-proving. It follows a pattern. There's always light present. It's remembered a long, long time. And it can have cosmic significance. Holy Mother once answered a disciple who came and told her that he had seen tiny, tiny creatures multiplying rapidly. Tiny, like shrimp, some kind of invertebrate creatures, and they were rapidly multiplying. And he had a feeling that this was a holy dream. Well, I would call that one of the second class, because Mother told him afterwards, "You have seen the birth of Prakriti. You have seen the birth of Prakriti, one of the cosmic principles." And I think that I will finish and let you ask questions by giving you a couple of quotations. The first one is from the West, from the Bible, from the Song of Solomon. You know the Song of Solomon, that famous romantic book in the Old Testament. The lover says to his beloved, "I sleep, but my heart watches. I sleep, but my heart watches. My heart stays awake." That heart of which he speaks, we would call the Atman, the unsleeping, unwinking, ineffaceable, eternal witness of everything. And here is Swami Vivekananda from Volume 2. "I am omnipresent, eternal. Where could I go? Where am I not already? I am reading this book of nature. Page after page I am finishing and turning over, and one dream of life after another goes away. Just as in dreams, so in life. Another page of life is turned over. Another dream of life comes, and it goes away, rolling and rolling. And when I have finished reading, I let it go and stand aside. I throw away the book, and the whole thing is finished. Alice wakes up, throwing up the pack of cards. The story is over, and she's come back to reality. That's as much as I have time to say today about sleep, dream, vision. So if you have questions, comments, this is the time for them. Stunned into silence. You're all stunned. Can't think of anything to say.
I'll break the silence.
Good.
You know, sometimes we hear, and I would like you, and you alluded to it, as we live, so we die. And if this life is a dream, and if we live in the way we should live, thinking of our Ishta,
yeah.
What happens in the last sleep? When the body, you know, goes away, do they see the God, the Ishta?
That's what the scriptures say. The scriptures say that the thought in your mind, meaning the mind as a whole, if the mind is brought together on the thought of the ideal, at the moment of death, then one goes to that place, merges into that being. Brahmaloka, call it if you want to, or you can call it Ramakrishna Loka or whatever. But that's what the scriptures tell us. I can't vouch for it, because I can't come back from death. But what the scriptures say is that the thought which is uppermost in the mind at the time of death is the one which guides the soul into the realm beyond. And you know the story of Janaka and his pet deer, and so all those stories from the Puranas, which tell you about what happens to the people whose mind is not in their Ishtam.
So, what happens in those cases? I think you were mentioning, Maharaj, the Bharat Raja, Horin Shishu.
Well, it was King Bharata, wasn't
yeah.
it? Not Janaka, Bharata, King
yeah,
Bharata.
Horin Shishu.
King Bharata had a deer,
right.
Pet deer. I'm sorry, I got the name wrong, you're right. King Bharata was, who had a pet deer, and as his death approached, and he was on his deathbed, all he could do was to think of his pet deer, and so he was reborn as a deer, or something like that. Those are nice Purana stories. I can't answer those, anything about them, truth of them. Any other questions?
I have a question. This a person who goes to samadhi, for example, Swami Vivekananda. I'm sure he went through samadhi.
Yes.
But all his waking hours, he was trying to do in this waking world. You know, good things
yes.
for people.
Yes.
Why does he come back, if he has gone to that state, why does he come back to the real world, waking hour?
So-called waking.
I thought if you reach samadhi, you have reached mm-hmm. the plateau.
Yes, Sri Ramakrishna explains this. He says, in the case of ordinary souls, most souls, the body lasts not more than 21 days if you get samadhi, nirvikalpa samadhi. If the soul gets nirvikalpa samadhi, the body drops off within 21 days. And that's the traditional explanation, traditional story. In the case of an avatar or his immediate disciples, we call them Ishwara Kotis, tips of Ishwara. They have an operation, an agenda to perform. They have a mission in this world. And so they come back and take a position called bhavamukha. Bhavamukha. A situation in which they can see both sides, the samadhi side and the maya side. And they appear to be involved in the operations of maya. They create an institution. They travel all over the world, give talks at the Parliament of Religions. That's the maya side. At any moment, such a person can dissolve that mind right back into the absolute. So those people are special souls who have, like Swami Vivekananda, a mission in the world. And their condition cannot be explained by the ordinary scriptures. I didn't have time to go into that. I wanted to go into that. What does a jivan mukta experience? But we had no time. So that's the explanation of that. Anybody else have questions?